Before we begin, a quick note. This episode contains discussions of trauma, suicide, and wartime violence. Content includes the sound of explosions. Discretion is advised.
Only about 10% of the individuals with mental health issues in the U.S. are getting any sort of treatment that is beneficial to them. So there's an incredible need across the U.S. and across the world for access to effective interventions.
The need for clinical professionals to help with cases of depression, suicide, and post-traumatic stress disorder far exceeds supply, with millions of people affected by mental health issues that are often left untreated and undiagnosed. Researchers are looking at ways technology could fill in the gaps.
People feel more comfortable, even veterans, feel more comfortable revealing sensitive issues like having PTSD, depression, other mental health issues to a virtual human than a human. There's no stigma, there's no judgment, they're not going to look at you funny because it's just a computer anyway.
And mobile apps, chatbots, and virtual reality are allowing for new ways to understand and interact with past trauma.
Now you're going to get attacked from a guy up on a rooftop to the left. With an RPG.
I can feel my entire body shaking as the explosions come and go.
This episode, we meet the psychologists and scientists studying how therapy guided by artificial intelligence can help us navigate our own well-being.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
I got into the military right when I got out of high school. Life was great. I was based out of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. I wish I could have continued on with that journey, but when the trauma happened to me, it stopped everything. It just put a stop on my whole life, and it destroyed me for so many years. It's crazy. My name is Abe Hart. I am a U.S. Navy veteran that now is employed by the Department of Veterans Affairs. I'll just tell you straight up, I was brutally raped in the military, and it was scary for me to actually come face to face with what happened to me.
After he was honorably discharged, he moved to California. Then he started using drugs. Eventually, he attempted suicide.
For myself, suicide was the only way because I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. I blamed myself for everything.
Soon he was homeless. He wound up in jail. Then he heard of a VA treatment program in the Bay Area.
I thought this could be a different way of life for me. So I just basically surrendered and said, okay, let me work this program and see what kind of results I get.
He spent the next 4 months in treatment for PTSD and substance abuse.
It was probably the most beneficial thing that I've ever been through in my life. I went in there with my head down. I came out of there with my head up, right?
In addition to in-person sessions with a therapist, he was given access to a VA-designed app called PE Coach, which stands for Prolonged Exposure. It lets patients take assessment tests, schedule follow-up appointments, or record themselves recounting their traumas during an in-person session and then listen to the recordings at home.
All the emotions that I felt when I went through these sessions were so indescribable, just intense. And the whole thing about this, you're supposed to listen to yourself over and over to where it gets so easy to listen to yourself that the trauma is not as strong as it used to be.
My name is Jason Owen. I'm a clinical psychologist at the National Center for PTSD. VA is the largest healthcare sector in the United States, and we serve more people than any other health system. But still, we know that we are not reaching many veterans who have mental health issues, and PTSD is one of the most prominent. And that's true not just for veterans, but in the general population as well.
He leads a team at the VA in Silicon Valley that builds mobile apps for veterans with mental health issues.
We know that PTSD is a huge problem. It's one of the worldwide, one of the top mental health conditions there is. And so mobile apps are a way to reach people that might not otherwise access care and a way to supplement the care that people are already receiving.
One of the apps his team developed is called PTSD Coach. In a research study, scientists found that veterans who use it are much more likely to seek out follow-up treatment with a human therapist.
So that's a big deal. You know, having a brief intervention that utilizes a mobile application that's not expensive, that doesn't require a high level of specialty care, but can get veterans who wouldn't otherwise access mental health services into the care that they need is important. But, you know, PTSD is not something that occurs in isolation.
Often, veterans with PTSD also experience anxiety, depression, and other issues.
We have apps that are designed to help with anger. We have apps that are designed to help with sleep, with depression, with smoking cessation, or cutting back on alcohol use.
A barrier to treatment is often a sense of shame or embarrassment. Mental health isn't just a sensitive topic, it's culturally stigmatized. That can make it harder for people to admit they need help, leaving otherwise treatable conditions underreported and undiagnosed.
We assume someone is weak, that there's something wrong with them when they have mental health condition or struggles, and therefore people feel reluctant to share that with other humans. My name is Gail Lucas, and I am a research assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science at USC, and my specialization is human-computer interaction.
Her team designed an artificially intelligent system called Ellie, a virtual human depicted visually in 3D on a screen. Ellie looks female and conducts patient interviews like a therapist.
People feel more comfortable, even veterans, feel more comfortable revealing sensitive issues like having PTSD, depression, other mental health issues to a virtual human than a human. There's no stigma, there's no judgment, they're not going to look at you funny because it's just a computer anyway. We also designed her to have a racially agnostic appearance, and it's really neat because several different participants from different ethnic backgrounds have said, wow, that's great. You chose someone that's like me.
Hi, I'm Ellie. Thanks for coming in today. I was created to talk to people in a safe and secure environment. I'm not a therapist, but I'm here to learn about people and would love to learn about you. I'll ask a few questions to get us started.
Research shows people are more comfortable opening up to therapists who are female and who look like them. The technology is currently in clinical trials for veterans who have experienced sexual trauma. As Ellie cycles through a bank of questions similar to what a human therapist would ask, a microphone and camera system track the subject's verbal and nonverbal cues, like tone and facial expression, in real time.
If you say, no, I haven't ever been in the service, you know, I'm not a veteran, she won't ask you questions about that because it would be very frustrating if she kept asking you, well, tell me about your service. So like a human that is doing a clinical interview can do branching and follow in on the questions that need additional care and attention, but stay away from ones that aren't of interest or necessary, we've programmed the technology to be able to discern between a yes answer and a no answer to these branching questions and go down the path as necessary.
The team even slows down Ellie's response rate to mimic the long pauses therapists use to give patients extra time to contemplate their own words. Tasking AI systems with some of the introductory grunt work like patient screening can be especially helpful in times when the number of available doctors is limited. But Lucas says Ellie is no replacement for a human therapist.
We can have this virtual human screener that helps them prioritize, wow, this person talked about suicide, we should get them to a clinician faster, and kind of gives maybe a stopgap kind of triage of letting someone talk about their issues. And that's something that a technological innovation is capable of, whereas truly expressing empathy, where that empathy is meaningful because it's a human giving the empathy, not a computer, that's something that we need humans for.
Elsewhere in the building, scientists are developing a more immersive method for confronting past trauma.
My name is Skip Rizzo. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I direct the Medical Virtual Reality Lab at the University of Southern California Institute for Creative Technologies.
His lab works on ways to use VR to help veterans deal with mental health issues, including PTSD from combat-related traumas or sexual assault. To help victims deal with these and other traumas, Rizzo creates virtual worlds that mimic the places soldiers were traumatized.
Most sexual trauma in the military is happening outside of U.S. bases. So we built civilian content, a small town with a bar area and alleys and vacant lots and motels and malls and military-type offices, the places where these things are commonly reported to have occurred. We just completed and published the first safety and feasibility trial in that area. and found not only statistically significant reductions in post-traumatic stress symptoms, but also clinically meaningful reduction.
With funding from the Department of Defense, Rizzo's lab developed an interactive VR tool called BraveMind. It looks like a video game. To use it, a patient dons a headset through which you can experience being in a combat zone. To help users feel like they're in that world, BraveMind can also incorporate other senses, like smell.
Well, you're looking at samples from a company up in Vermont, OVR, that is building a portable scent delivery system that can be mounted on a head-mounted display and puff out little microbursts of scent, pretty nasty scents over there, too, if you look at them. They're not perfumey scents. They're like rotting garbage, burning rubber, diesel fuel. But those are the relevant scents that bring people back to their deployment in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Rizzo's team also uses wearable sensors that measures the body's reaction.
You know, it's important to capture these kinds of responses because a lot of times if you rely exclusively on self-report, you do an interview with a patient, they'll say, oh yeah, I'm fine, everything's going well. But then you put them in a simulation, it's provocative, and you see their heart rate variability shift dramatically. And you see the recovery time and the physiological responding going a lot longer than you would expect, then that might give you a window into the soul, if you will, that the person may be having more than they're letting on verbally. But the action is in here in this headset. So what you see on the screen up here moving around is what the user sees in the VR headset as they turn around and look up and down in the space. And they would, if they're driving in the Humvee, as you're seeing here, they'd be sitting on this chair on the base shaker. If they're on a foot patrol, they would be holding that gun.
He's referring to a nearby rifle, which isn't real. To make the experience more natural, the team uses plastic weapons made to weigh the same as an M4 assault rifle. The virtual environment can be customized to match a soldier's past experiences.
I can adjust the time of day, the lighting conditions, the sound effects, the distance of an explosion. It can be right under the vehicle like an IED, or it can be off in the distance. Helicopters, jets flying over, insurgent attacks. All of that is being controlled by what we call a Wizard of Oz type interface, where the clinician is actuating all the stimuli in a fashion that makes it so that it mimics the story that the patient is telling. So this is the key thing about confronting the trauma, is that the patient needs to go back in their memory and tell their story as if it's happening right now. And we find that that effect really starts to pull out the emotion of the story a lot faster than traditional methods.
That's because, in a way, the brain gets tricked into thinking it's back in a combat zone.
The frontal lobes may be saying, I'm sitting in a lab at USC, at the Institute for Creative Technologies. Your amygdala is like saying, oh man, I'm back in Iraq, I'm back in Afghanistan. And that's what our goal is to activate those structures, but in a safe place. And in that fashion, we foster what we call extinction learning, or the reduction of anxiety at the core of any behavioral exposure approach.
All right.
All right, hook me up.
So, Wall Street Journal science editor Daniela Hernandez tried it out.
So I'm driving along a road. Am I in Iraq, Afghanistan? Is it?
This is Iraq, and I'm going to turn the sound on now.
Okay. So the helicopter sound is definitely jarring.
And you'll see some insurgents to the right. Okay, you're good.
Okay.
All right, take a step back. You're in the middle now. Blow up something off in the distance there, or we can bring it a little bit closer to you, like this.
Is the, oh my God.
So you see where that multi-sensory component
yes.
comes in, especially the body action.
I mean, I know I'm in a video game, essentially, but it's still, like, the explosions feel extremely real.
Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put you back in the vehicle real quick.
Okay.
And I'm going to put it to a brighter time of day.
Okay.
Fix that Humvee, and now you're going to get attacked from a guy up on a rooftop to the left with an RPG.
I can feel my entire body shaking as the explosions come and go. I almost find it hard to talk because my voice is vibrating so much from all the action that's going around. So I can imagine how if you have experiences that relate to this, where it would be extremely emotional to feel like you're in that scene again. And I imagine that first you have an interview with a clinician, and then this is tailored around that.
Exactly. This is the key element here is that this is not a replacement for good clinical skills. Basically, it's an amplifier. So the clinician spends the first three sessions understanding what the patient went through and then plotting the strategy for how they would invoke the exposure over time.
But this high-tech approach isn't the norm.
When we think about the way that we currently practice psychology and psychiatry, in my opinion, it's antiquated.
Adam Haim is a clinical psychologist at the National Institute of Mental Health.
So when we interact with a patient and we get information, they talk to us, they tell us how they're doing, by and large, currently, it's subjective. We give them an assessment instrument, and it says, in the last 2 weeks, have you felt A, B, C, or D? And someone has to recall how they felt, and the assessment instrument may be accurate or inaccurate. What we see technology potentially offering is objective measurement that's done on a continuous basis and obtained really in the wild.
Those objective measures include things like heart rate and blood pressure. The idea is that your body's reactions give scientists clues about your mental state. Haim is funding research that's aiming to leverage those biological hints to improve mental health care. For people who might be at risk of suicide, that's especially important. One study suggests that most people who act on suicidal thoughts do so within an hour.
There are some people who are sort of always having suicidal thoughts, but there are lots of people that go from feeling perfectly calm or a little bit distressed to feeling pretty acutely suicidal in a pretty short amount of time. So we need to figure out ways to make them really effective in those really short periods of time when people are feeling really distressed.
Evan Kleiman is a clinical psychologist at Harvard. He's using wearables to try to predict risk for suicide, which is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. The National Institute for Mental Health funds his work. The goal is to find ways to intervene with the help of mobile technologies because the times when people need help the most are also when they're least likely to have someone around who can help them. To build such a system, Kleiman is starting with something called skin conductance.
So it's this sense where you sort of start to sweat, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure increases a little bit. People are most familiar with it probably when a police officer pulls behind you on the highway, but it's something that we experience whenever we have really intense negative emotion.
But skin conductance can change due to exercise or stress. That presents a challenge. This is where machine learning and more data come in. To make the system more accurate, they're using data like GPS coordinates, call logs, and texting history. And this naturally raises concerns about privacy.
What we really care about isn't exactly where someone is. Rather, we care about, did they leave their house at all during the day? Or did they go to the bar? For things like call logs, there's no way for us to see someone's phone number. We see that someone made a call. And what we found is that most people are comfortable giving us these data because they know that there's some hope that it could help people in the future.
When you're dealing with mental health care, you're dealing with incredibly sensitive information. And so there's worry that that might end up in the wrong hands. And as we've seen with recent privacy leaks and data sharing scandals, your data doesn't always end up where you thought it did.
Again, The Wall Street Journal's Daniela Hernandez.
The rise in interest in using technology for mental health can be attributed to a couple of factors. Artificial intelligence is getting better and better at deciphering language and meaning, and that makes it easier for engineers to design things like chatbots. These are basically software-based agents which can text and talk to us about our problems, and we're starting to see more companies develop such things.
For all of the promise, we have to remember tech is not a cure-all.
Along the same lines, we have to keep in mind that technology also has exacerbated some of our mental health care issues. There's tech addiction and cyberbullying, and we're just beginning to understand that. And while the use of apps and social media and text-based chatbots can maybe help us feel better, we also have to understand that tapping into technology might be a double-edged sword.
Scientists also worry that patients will tire of these apps and stop using them, like many do with fitness trackers.
People get really excited at first about using technology to record data about their weight, the number of steps they take, how well they sleep, but then they stop using them. With therapy, that's a concern for clinicians. They don't want people to lose interest and drop off. They want to keep them engaged in getting the care that they need. So scientists are working on ways to make apps stickier so that patients who need help keep coming back to these apps and see them as a long-term resource rather than the flavor of the month.
Patients can't take their therapists home with them, but these apps go anywhere smartphones can. For some, like Abram Hart, the sexual assault victim we met earlier, that's already making a big impact.
One of the hardest times for a person, from myself and my experience, is when I sit down at home by myself and I'm laying in bed, or I'm just sitting there thinking, right? No TV, because those thoughts will sometimes come in your head. That's when you go to the app, right? And normally a craving or an urge to use or act upon or anger, any of those emotions normally last for about 10 minutes. That 10 minutes that you're able to use by using the apps allows you to not only get more education about what's going on with you, but also it allows you to work through that 10 minutes. And by the time you know, it's over and you learn something, you feel more comfortable and you're okay.
And while he wouldn't call himself cured, he says life is a whole lot better now.
I go through anxiety attacks. I still go through the trauma. My sleep is still poor. I have nightmares. The difference is I have confidence in myself today. I know it wasn't my fault. I'm completely happy with where I am in life. And really, it's because of the programs down here. It's been a miracle. I just enjoy life every day. You know, I go out. I had so many problems going out in public. It's crazy. I go to events, sporting events. I was at the beach on Saturday. You know, I rode horses 2 weeks before that.
Hart is now a peer specialist at the center where he was once treated and helps other veterans struggling under similar circumstances.
Let my experience show others that, hey, it could be done. And you know what? The trauma that you face, whether it be sexual assault, whether it be traumatic brain injury, whether it be combat, you could get through this. You can, and you don't have to commit suicide. Because that's how I felt for many years. Life is good. Life is good today.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Anthony Green and Daniela Hernandez, with help from Brian Gutierrez and Laura Sim. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in the newsroom in New York.